Hello, and welcome to another episode of Shipping and Handling. I am your host, Jennifer Udden.
And I'm your co-host, Bridget Smith.
So before we dive into a discussion of the Raven Cycle, which I'm so excited about, we have obviously delayed doing the book club because...
Neither of us has read it.
Neither of us has read it.
To be perfectly honest.
I own it. And actually, hilariously...
I have not even gotten that far.
Hilariously, while I was in Tennessee... there was a library book sale, like, in front of the IGA supermarket in the town that the cabin is in. And so it was, like, $3 for a bag of books.
Nice.
So I bought two. And they had one of the Vorkosigan Saga books in there. I can't remember. It was, like, Captain Vorpal's something. It's got one of the most amazing covers I've ever seen. So I bought that. It's just like, I'll get to it eventually. But
yeah. We'll get there down the line.
Yeah, but I've had other things to read, including the entirety of the Raven Cycle.
Yay, finally!
I feel like I've been promising to read that book for, like, 3 months on this podcast. Just like, yeah, someday.
And, of course, you put it off until the entire series was out.
I did, but I'm really glad I did, because Sorry. If you hear weird things, it's because my microphone is trying to off its mortal coil.
I think that the leaf is a little slanted.
Okay.
So you
Let's
need
try
to...
this again.
I think you just need to give it a little bit of upper legs there in the front.
Hold my hand on it like this. Hold my hand gently on the microphone. So I'm glad I waited. I'm glad I read it all at once, because I had forgotten a lot of what happened in The Raven Boys.
Well, I have now read The Raven Boys 3 times because I read it the first time. No, I guess it's 4 times because I read it... on its own, and then before every book that has come out since. So I've reread them all. I think the first one is still my favorite, though maybe that's just because I keep reading it so many times.
I think at this point, my favorites are, my favorite sort of in order is 2, 4, 1, and 3.
Okay.
And actually, I could probably switch around 4 and 1.
Yeah.
Depending on the day.
Yeah.
But, So in case you don't know what we're talking about,
this is the hardest book series to describe because it's so, like, Welsh kings, rich teenagers,
boarding school, crushing poverty,
yes,
abuse,
psychics,
gayness,
fast cars,
Russians, no, Bulgarians, he's from Bulgaria, or the Bulgarian mob. It's, so I haven't quite, so the book is nominally about this girl, Blue Sargent, who is the only non-psychic member of this family of psychics, like genuine ability having,
yes,
tarot card reading,
real life
psychics.
Yeah, and it's kind of fun because it's sort of an assembled family. I think it's her mother and her mother's sister.
There's, like, cousins. And
cousins and someone's kids and a friend that's just sort of living with them. It's
you
a weird
sort of
cobbled
have,
together family, and it's lovely.
You have the impression of one of those big houses with lots of rooms that, like, mm-hmm. you're never entirely sure who's living there at any one time, but someone's
there's
always...
There's, like, at least 6 women in this household at
but
all
but
times.
But someone's always baking or making, yeah. or making mixed beverages, which I really appreciate.
Yes.
And so she... there's this thing that they do every year. I love that it was, like, a service that they provided to, like,
yes.
the town of Henrietta, Virginia, which is where the book is set, where every year they go to this one sort of old abandoned church on St. Mark's Day, which is some random day. I don't know. It's in April sometime.
Yeah.
And they
is
basically...
Is it St. Mark's or...
St. something. It's someday.
No, I think you're thinking of St. Mark's Place.
No, I think it's St. Mark's Day. It's some saint that's not all souls. It's not all saints.
No,
or
no,
all
no.
Souls
it's in like April. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so look this up.
Yeah, Google that because I don't know. So anyway, so while Bridget's Googling that, while we're fact checking our own knowledge of the series, it's not on. No, I want it on time. Time. Okay. While Bridget is fact checking that, so she's in this abandoned.
It's St. Mark's Eve.
St. Mark's Eve. Okay.
You were.
Close.
You were.
So basically, there is this. It starts out, she's in this churchyard, like there's an abandoned cemetery, and it's on what she and her family call the corpse road, which is sort of this road that the dead travel. And every year, the souls or spirits of the people who are about to die in the next year wander through this graveyard, and Blue can't see anyone, so she's just sort of there for, like,
she takes the notes
and she writes down the names. And but then at the beginning of the Raven Boys, she sees her first spirit, and it's this kid Gansey, who turns out to be one she's never met before. And then it turns out that Gansey himself, Richard Gansey III, was actually near the church that night, sort of staking it out, and didn't hear anything or see anything, but has a recording of her saying, "Who are you?" and him saying, "Gansey."
Yeah.
So that sort of starts this whole thing. And Gansey is obsessed with this Welsh king named Glendower, who supposedly was transported to the New World for reasons.
Welsh version of King Arthur. So rather than going to Avalon, they took him to
Virginia,
North America.
Yeah.
and the idea is that they traveled on ley lines, which are lines of energy that crisscross the earth. And the Corpse Road is a ley line. And it came from Wales on a ley line, was buried. And
so basically the rest of the series is sort of the Scooby gang trying to find Glendower, sort of for various reasons of their own. And those reasons change sort of over the course of the book. And then also trying to prevent other more evil people from finding Glendower, because if you do find it, then you get sort of like unlimited power.
A wish. Yeah.
I love this series.
Yep.
I love it so much. So why do you love it so much?
I really love the very many kinds of relationships and the kinds of love that you see on display in these books. You've got like this household full of women who have assembled themselves a family, and this group of boys who are all sort of misfits in one way or another, some unexpectedly so, who've again cobbled themselves together, and the way Blue sort of fits into both of them, and the actual like dating relationships that come up
so good
and evolve out of these various connections that they've made. And it's so dependent on their feelings for each other,
and there's never a moment where sort of, I mean, what I really hate in books is sort of like, you know, withholding emotional information for like plot value, and that never happens, and it always makes it more interesting.
Yeah,
where they're like, I'm going to tell you this complicated fucking thing that I don't know how to deal with, and then, you know, it just sort of like leads to the reason I think I like it, and this is something that I've felt more and more as I've, you know, in the days since I finished it, because I think I read Dream Thieves, or most of Dream Thieves, all of Blue Lily, Lily Blue, and all of The Raven King in, like, 3 days. And I was kind of, like, taking notes, like, as I went, because I wanted to remember, but of course I forgot my notebook.
Oh, but actually,
it has the feel to me of, like, classic literature.
Yes.
Like, classic children's literature. It reminds me of, like, the Madeline Langle's, like, other series, that other family that she had, you know? And those were so fun.
And it's a little bit Susan Cooper
A little bit, yeah. Except Susan Cooper, like, fell apart for me massively in, like, book two. And I was just like, oh, no. I think I was just way too old when I read them. But it has that feeling of, like, things I could reread forever.
Yes.
Because I feel like at every point in my life, there's going to be something where I'm like, oh, God, the feeling.
It's enchanting, too.
It is.
I'm currently going through a phase where I'm trying to decide if I've always been this picky or if it's a new thing from being in publishing.
I remember you were talking about that last time.
Yeah.
And we had not decided.
I think it's probably I've always been this picky, considering how many times I reread books rather than go looking for new ones. But, yeah, it's this feeling I had. I read the first Raven Boys book on a plane. I had read Maggie Stiefvater's first book, Lament, and I hadn't been terribly impressed. And then I got...
Was it Shiver or was it Lament?
Lament is her first.
Okay.
Shiver was, like, the big one. But,
right, okay.
Lament was her actual first published book. And then I got a galley of the Raven Boys.
Bridget was the coolest girl in school for a while because it was like the pimpest galley I'd ever seen.
Oh,
this is, of course, before Illuminae, which was a fucking hardcover galley, which I was like, I have not read it, but I keep it just to be like, someday one of my fucking books is going to have a hardcover fucking galley.
It came with a cover and everything.
But it came in, like, the Raven Boys came in a box. It was embossed.
Yep.
The box had a box. Yep. Like, it had a protective box that came in. It was like,
it was a whole big thing.
Whole big thing.
But so I was like, I You know, I've already read a book by this author. I didn't like it very much. I'm probably not going to like this one. But I brought it with me on the plane to Sirens Conference right before the book came out. And I was like, you know what? I'll read it on the plane. It'll be fine. And I was like, oh, God, I don't want the plane to land. Can we just make some circles until I finish this book? Everyone's okay with that, right?
Everyone's fine, yeah.
It was just absolutely transportive. I was like reading it as I was walking off the plane. Mm-hmm. I couldn't stop. I was so swept up in it.
Yeah. And even though, you know, obviously a four book series is going to have its problems,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that we can talk about those, even though it has problems that I think, you know, shouldn't be sort of swept aside, it was still so layered and interesting. Mm-hmm. And there were issues that it refused to let go.
Yeah.
That I just loved. Like, the fact that class and money plays such
it's
a
so
huge role.
Woven into it's the not just fabric of the story.
It's not just subtext, it's text. Like,
yeah.
there's so...
But it's both, which is what makes it so powerful.
It's so good. So among Gansey's sort of, like, crew of people that he's, like, picked up, there is... So Gansey is very rich. He's sort of, like, old money Virginia.
Yeah.
And there's all these great moments where you sort of see him turning into, like, Dick Gansey the Third, rather than just sort of, like, the nerd who's like, man, Wales!
This Welsh king! Ancient tapestries!
and, you know, more on that in a second. But, like, and then there's Adam Parrish, who is basically, like, a scholarship student at this
mm-hmm.
boys' school.
Trailer Park Kid.
Speaking of pronunciation, how the fuck do you pronounce Aglianby?
I have never figured it out. I have no idea.
I've just decided that the G is silent, and it's Aglianby.
Ah, that makes a lot of sense.
That's the only thing that it does make sound fucking stupid. Yeah. I mean, not that, you know, boarding schools don't have Choate. Like, I'm sorry. Sorry to all you Choate alums out there, but
it
sounds...
I think Choate was someone's name.
I'm sure Aglianby was someone's name,
That's
but, you know, Choate sounds like Chode in the modern parlance. Anyway, so Adam Parrish, who's a scholarship kid, like, literally lives in a trailer. And then there's Ronan Lynch, who's sort of, like, a different kind of rich. He's, like, weird rich, like, eccentric rich.
He's, like, black market rich.
Black market rich, for reasons that are amazing!
Yes!
And so Adam, because he's sort of, like, the poorest person in this... friend group, like, hates it when Gansey tries to make things easy for him.
Yeah.
Or when he tries to, like, give him what he sees as charity or get, because he can't, and there's all these wonderful moments where he tries to get Gansey to understand how it feels to him to get sort of, like, handouts or what he thinks of as handouts. He wants so badly to say that he can do it on his own.
Yeah. It's also really interesting because Blue is also poor. And part of the reason why this household of psychics lives together is because they couldn't afford houses on their own.
They have they have the phone room, which is where the psychic hotline that they've set up. The phone gets answered. It's so wonderful.
Yes. But so the way that she and Adam deal with being poor next to these incredibly rich boys is... it's similar in some ways and very, very different in other ways. And I really like the interplay there.
Well, and I can't remember which book it was in because I read them so quickly. But there was this wonderful conversation between Gansey and someone else, maybe Noah, who's another character that we don't really... I mean, that's the one thing that I actually will refuse to spoil because that reveal in book one, I was
so
like
good.
Screaming on the phone to Bridget.
Yes.
Like, but so Gansey's talking to one of his other friends and he sort of like kind of has a moment where he gets it. I think he might be talking to Blue, where he talks about how, you know, he's, you know, rich in money, but he's also rich in love. Like, his family genuinely loves him, and they genuinely, like, want to support him, and, you know, in all the moments where they're, like, sort of, like, fighting, or, like, it's awkward between them, it's all, you can tell that in Gansey's family, it's all from a place of, like, affection.
Mm-hmm.
And even, like, Ronan's family, which is, like, deeply fucked up, still has this basis of, like, you know, love and affection. And a lot of the problems that they have is because his father was murdered and, like, the sort of center of the love was taken away. And then Blue has this, like, this huge extended family that all just, like, loves her and depends on her and adores her. And Adam doesn't have anyone like that because his parents are, like, fucking abusive and crazy.
Yes.
So, yeah, it was just, like... But there's never a moment where Adam's like, yeah, cool, I'll let you buy me stuff.
No.
And, like, even in the moments where he is, like, sort of given things, he's sort of, like, aware that he's being managed. But yeah. he's just like, well, in this moment, I am choosing not to fight you on this. But I don't like it. Yeah, I feel like we got off on a little bit of a tangent there. But, like, that was one of the things, one of the many things I love about the series is, like, that the class issues are not swept under the rug. Because I feel like there are books where it's, like, set... I can't really think of one specifically where there's... It's, like, a boarding school book. And, like, the issue of money is, like, never...
do you mean by poorest?
Yeah. So yeah, but it does, it feels really classic. It feels really like,
yeah, the thing that I have talked about a lot is, so there's this, it sort of gets muddled what this place is in later books in the series, but it starts out as basically like an enchanted forest.
Caveswater.
Yes.
Woo.
It's this like section of the forest that is weirdly, unexpectedly magical, and time runs differently there, and the seasons are different there. But one of the things that I really admired is when these characters are walking into this place for the first time, you can feel it around you while you're reading. It makes the earth itself feel magical in a way that most places don't bother, or many books don't bother to do with their settings.
And it doesn't stay the same kind of magic as the series progresses. Like, it's like the feeling changes, but it's always unmistakably sort of like a different place, like a separate place that is weird and has its own rules. And as you meet people in the book who have also had experiences at this place, Kavinsky, you know, seeing the way that they interact with that enchanted place versus the way like the characters do.
And also the way that it depends on the ley lines, which sort of ties it in inextricably with a lot of the other, with all, a lot of the plot elements that are going on, even without the sort of reveals that come later in the series. But it's, I mean, on the one hand, I kind of think ley lines are nonsense, like, as a scientifically minded person, but on the other hand, I kind of don't want them to be.
I mean, they're not something that I really sort of like. I think that there are many other like more pernicious like magical concepts that you know we have in our society, like vaccines causing autism.
Yeah,
that I think that we you can just roots and herbs can can solve your problems. Like, no, they fucking can't. No. You know what's great? Not having polio. Like, okay,
it's super great actually. So the idea, and I also really like in, I think it's the last book. Or is it the third book?
So we should just say that, like, from now on, here be spoilers.
Spoilers all over the place.
So up till now, I don't think we've spoiled anything major, but I think that from this point on, I'll give you a timestamp in the episode. We're going to spoil some shit.
So in either
because I can't keep talking around that thing that happened.
Yes. Yeah. So in, I think, the third book, What's-His-Face the Professor comes over from England.
Mallory.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're like trying to figure out where the ley lines fall exactly in this part of rural Virginia. And he's like, you know, in England, if you don't have some monument of significance on a line every 2 miles, it doesn't count as a ley line. It's just a coincidence. In North America, you can't have that.
Yeah.
Like, that's just, there are not permanent structures that are that old. And I loved that element of it.
Well, and I mean, to bring up Professor Mallory for a minute, there was a moment, I think, in book two, where I was convinced that the French guy that had hired the gray man, I was convinced that that was Mallory.
Oh.
Because he talked about him as... Because it seemed like if this were sort of like a lesser author, that would have been the same person. Like, Mallory would have been secretly
evil. That would have been the, like,
and would have been. But I think that it's a really interesting, I think that the whole, that there's so much about the books that are also like a really interesting commentary on the idea of like transactional magic. That like, because a lot of books, you know, play with this idea that like magic has a price, and like you can't really do magic or have magic or make something magical without something else sort of needing to power
cost.
It. The cost of it. And so the whole idea of this like world of like collectors of magical items.
Yes.
And, you know, Kavinsky sort of like creating Mitsubishis, like, oh my God, just like what a, but the idea that, you know, that was awesome, but like it cost Caveswater something every time he did that.
It drained it.
And like, you know, what if Caves, I just found that whole thing really interesting. And I really liked that because I was genuinely expecting, like, whoever had hired the gray man was gonna, because in book one, I think, when he was like, yeah, you know, you could try this ritual, you know, my friend only lost a little bit of his skin, I was just like, well, that sounds like something a sociopath would say. And a sociopath sounds like the guy who hired the gray man. Also, yeah. I'm not really sure how I feel about the sort of, like, redemption of the gray man. That's one area that I'm still not, like, 100%, like,
yeah,
sold on.
He is a very interesting character, because he's, like, an academic and a poet. Also a
murderer, yeah.
Who, you know, well, I suppose the thing is, once he figured out the Grey Warren wasn't a thing, it was a person, he stopped trying to get it.
True. Although, you know, he, like, broke Declan's face.
Yeah.
A lot. And I'm pretty sure he, like, killed several other people in the book. Right? Because he covers up their death. He, like, hides them in the... like, puts on their shoes and, like, walks around the clearing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, so is this a good point to sort of do a little bit on, like, things we thought were not as successful? I do think that the introduction of Henry Chang as a character was confusing. I really liked him, and I actually really liked the role that he ended up playing in the friendship. I'm not really sure, like, how I feel about... because he came in so late.
Oh, yeah. It's honestly, to me, we talked a little bit about this before, but to me, he feels like an author who got the very valid critique that her series was incredibly white.
So white. It's like, this is not intended as like a...
It's accurate.
It's so white.
It's very white.
Yeah.
Which I think is also pretty true of rural Virginia.
No,
but
it's actually not. Like, there are many... I mean, there might be still sort of like, you know... some people don't live in some areas, but like, yeah, but there is still like, there's black people in Virginia. Like,
it's
there's
true.
Hispanic people in Virginia. There's all kinds of people in Virginia.
Yes.
Like, it's not, you know, yeah, it's,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that this was a critique that is correct. And I think she recognized that. She's talked about hearing that and being like, yeah, you're absolutely right. If I could go over and start over from the beginning, I would change that. But she can't. And so bringing this character in the fourth book to be really important felt like a...
he did come in a little bit in Blue Lily, Lily Blue.
He was a, like, not even tertiary character. He, like, had a couple of lines.
Right.
In Blue Lily, Lily Blue.
The thing that I appreciated about him is that it's sort of... he sort of broadened the world beyond sort of, like, the evil French guy in Boston. Mm. I know he's not French, but, like, he has a French name, so, like, that's sort of what I think of. Right? Is that?
There's
the three evil French triplets.
Yes.
Whose daughter is that guy's wife. Wife?
Yes.
Wife.
Yes, wife. I think the guy himself is not French.
The guy himself is not French. What I liked, too, is that it sort of punctured there was this sort of idea that sort of was pervasive for me in the first two books that, you know, that these four teens are, like, the only ones to ever have suffered in the name of, like, finding something magical. And, like, I did like that there was sort of this person who was like, okay, well, you know, I have been through some shit in the name of Cabe's Water, even though I didn't know that was what it was at the time. And he's sort of, like, this kind of fun presence. Whereas I feel like the 14s can sometimes be like, the fate of the world, Glendower, my life has no meaning.
Like, they are incredibly obsessive.
They're obsessive, and I think that because Blue kind of gets, like, starts out from a place of, like, not being obsessive, and then gets drawn into it, and then she obviously, you know, has these very strong emotional attachments to people.
Yeah.
But I think it also sort of showed that, like, you know, one of Gansey's sort of, like, weaknesses is that he sort of would tell everybody what he was doing, but he wouldn't trust anybody with what he was doing. Mm. And by him sort of trusting Henry with stuff, you know, it made his plan work. It made him spoiler alert, not die at the end. That was the thing that was spoiled for me.
Was that
Noah's sacrifice. I know. I was just like,
That is sort of an important part of it.
Yeah. So I don't think that all the stuff that I just said undermines the fact that he does feel very last minute. But
yeah.
I do think that it did serve a purpose that I really liked, because it was getting real dire there for a while.
Yeah. He's not a lightweight character, I guess.
He's not just there to sort of be the comic relief,
no.
which I love. He had, like, he stuff had, like, to do.
He had stuff to do, but he was also someone who is not, he was not nearly as obsessive as the rest of them, and he was sort of like, okay, guys, but maybe this is not everything. Like, yeah. Let's make some jokes. Let's go have a party. Like, this is going to be okay.
Well, and also, I really liked that it showed, like, you saw Gansey see... Like, this wasn't sort of, like, as overt as I kind of would have liked, but you saw Gansey see the limits of his knowledge. Because there's all these scenes where he's sort of, like, taking Adam to parties and, like, you know, trying to get him to sort of, like, learn how to network like a human and not someone that hates everyone. But you see him sort of, like, encounter this whole other group at Allenby.
Let's go that.
With at the school.
The Vancouver crowd,
which I love. I mean, that's sort of, like, explicitly coded to me as, like, people who are not white.
Yeah.
Which I wish that it had been a little bit more overt, but I thought that him recognizing that for all of his sort of, like, networking, he really only meant networking with, like, people that looked like him.
Yeah. It's also,
And all of them sort of had this idea of, like, Allenby and, like, the group, and, you know, what does it mean to be, like, an Allenby kid?
Yeah.
But, like, it sort of, that idea seemed to exclude Henry and his friends. Does that make sense? Am I making any sense?
Yeah, they had, like, their own set of rituals and their own set of slang and in-jokes and everything. And it was very clear that they had this... It was sort of like a fraternity that they had. But, yeah, they seemed to very obviously cling to each other because there wasn't a lot else out there.
And I thought that was also helpful because, you know... In any kind of closed environment, you are gonna form.
Oh, cliques, absolutely. You know, so. Yeah, it's.
But so I think that, you know, the obvious persistent whiteness of the series and the last minute addition. I do like that she wasn't, like, retconning the entire thing. Oh. Like, oh yeah, everyone's Asian now. Like, everyone's black. I'm like, J.K. Rowling, stop. Just stop telling us things about your series. Like, stop. just stop.
Let it go.
Did you find the ending satisfying? Because I did, but no. I've talked to people that haven't, so.
It's, the thing is, okay, the problem may have been that I had such low expectations for the first book and was so absolutely blown away by it that I had really high expectations for what she was going to do with the ending. And, I think she sort of did the only thing she could, but I found it really disappointing.
See, I'm the opposite. I had no expectations for the first book. Super loved it. And then because I super loved it, I was just like, everything else is going to be a disappointment. Fact that I enjoyed it sort of said to me, like, okay, well, this actually isn't garbage. So. But I felt so, I mean, the ending, you know, I liked that sort of the idea of sacrifice was continued, that, you know, that kind of thing sort of came up again.
I think it for me, it started going awry with the, like, weird demon bug. I felt like that took it away from, which is the end of Blue Lily, Lily Blue.
Yeah.
But that whole thing seemed to exist to me on a different plane from what the rest of it was. The rest of it was sort of like human drama intertwined with the Earth's magic. And the demon existed on some other level.
Well, but the reason I liked all that stuff is what is a little bit what I was saying before, the idea that you can sort of, like, profit off of this magic. So basically there's this demon bug thing that gets brought out of the forest by this unscrupulous person who thinks that they could just sort of casually harness it the way that, you know, all the other artifacts in her life have been sort of casually sort of placed in glass cases.
Yeah.
And I like that ended with, like, going incredibly badly.
It did not work out.
You know, it did, I think, feel like a little bit of a dead end, but I didn't feel like it was wasted time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it just completely changed the direction I thought the story was going, and it completely changed everything it changed the stakes. It didn't, like, increase them, it changed them, I felt, in a way that didn't work for me, and it was also something that I was not particularly interested in. I was much more interested in the sort of, the interaction between modern day and history and legends and the way that we talk about history and legends, and the way that we sort of dwell on the earth and interact with the earth, and all of those things were really interesting to me. And just the demon has nothing to do with any of that. We have no idea how the demon got there. It's so, like, Gwenllian, who is another sleeper, she makes perfect sense within the context of this story. The demon doesn't to me.
I guess that's true. I hadn't really thought about that. That does make sense.
Yeah.
That does make sense.
So I think from that
fair point, Bridget.
Yeah, thanks. So when I read that in that's the epilogue of Blue Lily, Lily Blue, and I was like, I don't know if I like where this is going.
Yeah.
I was really into it up until that point. I was like, oh no, this is something different. So the fact that was so, and that the climax was initiated by this other woman who had nothing to do with the rest of the story.
Yeah.
And this demon, to me, seemed just like, seemed like an invasion of this book that I had really liked. Mm. I will say I am incredibly glad. I like found it extremely satisfying that the whole anticlimax of Glendower being actually dead and not actually a sleeper. I read that and I was like, oh, that's perfect. So yes.
Well, and I think that one of the things I like the most about the series is like everyone sort of continuing plan, like changing plans for what they're going to do.
Yes.
When they get the favor.
Yeah. They're adapting.
I love that. You know, it just isn't the one thing from the beginning.
And it does this nice thing where it's like, there's no one thing that will ever satisfy you.
Yeah.
No one thing will make your life complete.
Yeah. And I think that that's especially helpful for Adam because, so at the beginning of the book, at the beginning of the series, there's this wonderful scene where from Adam's point of view, you sort of learn his reasons for wanting to go to this fancy ass private school that's in his hometown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's,
it's sort of like the rich kids poor town.
He's at a grocery store and his mom's debit card has just been declined for like some eggs or something.
Yeah.
And then a kid that might be Ronan but probably isn't Ronan comes through and just buys something without thinking of it. And he's just like, that's what I'm going to do. So from the beginning, and I love the specificity of the sort of like
the
hope.
Specific moment. Yeah.
The specificity of that moment. And then, you know, in the rest of the series where he talks about like, he always does those little mini lists of things he wants. And it's like, you know, I want a stainless steel apartment in a dustless city.
Mm.
I was just like, oh, oh my God. And it's all that, it's like incredibly like concrete and evocative. And those are his dreams throughout. He wants, you know, physical security. He wants physical safety. And then when he gets it, you sort of see that change, you know, once he has physical security, even if he doesn't have financial security.
No, but he like gets his own place and he doesn't have to deal with his parents anymore.
He still, you know, those wants haven't gone away, but he still sort of like can go beyond them. I don't know what I'm saying, but I love it so much.
I admit I was a little underwhelmed with the actual ending where Gansey dies. I don't know, I think that was probably the point where I had such high expectations that nothing she could do would actually fulfill them. It made perfect sense in the world that she had constructed and everything that she'd seeded from the very first page of the of the very first book, but I was just like, it may have been that it was just too, it was like, it was a best of both worlds ending, and I think that is, a lot of people like those, and usually I like those, but I sort of wanted something to happen. I don't know. I don't know what I wanted.
Well, I think that for me, you know, the reason I like the ending, so basically Gansey dies, and they basically convince Cabeswater to sacrifice itself.
Mm.
To bring him back.
Yeah. Or it's like reconstructing a new version of him.
Yeah.
Sort of.
But what I liked about that is that, A, it sort of parallels the Glendower myth itself.
Mm.
That, you know, he's now this sort of person outside of time.
Yeah.
Even though he's like a person, you know. And I also liked that, you know, the whole thing is about sacrifice. And they're having to sacrifice this thing that is so vital to them.
Mm.
Like, you know, Ronan, like, I'm still very confused about, like, what's going to happen to Ronan. Can he ever, like, dream again?
Yeah.
You know, there's this whole portion of the world that's going to be cut off from their exploration. And it's going to affect all of them in, like, very specific ways. And they have to give that up so that Gansey can live.
Hmm.
I actually really like that because it wasn't just one person sacrificing something. It was, like, something that they all had experience of and all drew power from and all drew sort of, like, meaning from. And that had to go away. Because they loved their friend more.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. I don't know.
But like I said, I mean, I feel like this is going to be one of those series that I'm going to be rereading like every year for the rest of my life. Yeah. So I guess next year we should have like our annual, like, let's revisit the Raven cycle. Well, on that note, we're about 40 minutes in. So let's check in to the interwebs and see if we, I don't think we have any questions on Twitter.
I didn't see any.
Yeah, me neither. Messages. My friend Laura says, in reply to my tweet about we're recording a new episode tonight, so keep those questions coming. We'll be discussing the Raven cycle. And she says, this is all I want, truly. So I don't think I see any other questions. So let's go to Tumblr. The Tumblr app is the bane of my fucking existence. I hate it so much. Okay. So I think, let me just check email real quick to see if there's anything we can answer faster. Because we had a question from
last time.
That, okay, so it doesn't look like we have any questions from email. So last time when we were recording with Mika, there was a question on Tumblr that was from a Cool Shades Anon asking, how do you tell your agent you quit, you're done with writing, and you don't want to do it anymore? And what kind of fallout can you, and we were just like, wow, that's a situation, friend.
I think I do think that this is a situation where your agent's response is like the least of your worries. It's one thing to say to your agent, like, I've decided to leave you for another agent. In that case, they might be kind of annoyed. But if you are saying, like, I just don't want to write anything anymore, there's not that much that they can do about that. Like, they may try to convince you to stay, and they may want to, like, still consider you a client in case you change your mind down the line.
I've definitely told people.
Yeah. But, I mean, they're not going to be like, how dare you? It's
the situation
like
in which
that.
I can picture how dare you is if you have books under contract.
Oh, yeah. That is one problem.
Or you are out on submission with a project.
Yeah.
In which case, that is not going to be an easy or fun or short conversation.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing that I would... your phone just made a really
exciting... Sorry, I got an email, guys.
they probably can hear it, but my microphones aren't that powerful. The other thing that I would counsel in this situation is, like, you should take a good, long, hard look at what it is you are reacting to.
Yes. Why do you feel this way?
Is it because nothing you are writing is selling? Well, that's one problem. Is it because you don't enjoy the act of writing anymore? Well, that's another problem. Is it because nothing you're writing seems interesting? Well, that's another problem. And all those problems are really things that can be solved.
Yeah.
And
honestly, some of them might be, I am just going to write a thing for fun and not care if anyone buys it.
Yeah.
And in that case, it's sort of like telling your agent, I'm working on this thing that you're probably not going to ever see. Yeah. But I need to do it for myself.
Yeah. Is it because you're tired of traditional publishing? Is it because you don't like, you know, going through the whole submission response nonsense? You know, there's a whole host of reasons, you know, to want to quit writing. And, you know, this is not to say that, you know, your feelings aren't valid and that, you know, you'll feel better in the morning. Like, you know, you may go through all these questions and realize, like no, actually, I fucking hate it. I want to go. I want to go away forever.
Which is fair.
But I had the feeling that the conversation, if you are not under contract, will go better than you think it will.
Oh, man. If you have books under contract and you tell your agent you don't want to write them, that's going to be a whole thing.
Because that means in most contracts you have to pay any money that they've paid you for those books back.
Yes. And your agent is not going to pay their commission back, so you are going to have to pay their share of it as well.
Yeah.
So, like, it's not just money that you received and you're going to return. It's that plus the commission of that you paid to your agent.
Because the publisher considers that money that they've paid for something that, you know, even if you never, you know, turn in the book, so you're never going to get the DNA, you're never going to get the pub payment, they've still paid you for something that you...
Yeah, you have to pay back the on-signing advance. Yeah. And, You'll it's not prob- fun. Also, you will probably never, if you change your mind, never be able to sell to that publisher again.
Yeah.
Just FYI.
So, yeah, I mean, so this is, you know, something that I would think really long and hard about if you are in that position where you don't want to write anymore and you are under contract for something. Talk to your agent. I mean, yeah. Especially if you have a good relationship with your agent.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully you do. Going to them and saying, like, listen, I'm under contract for 2 more books. What the fuck do I do? I don't want to write them. I'm having so many problems. Like,
yeah.
The agent will, I guarantee you, like, hopefully drop everything. And, like, because they don't get paid if you don't get paid.
Yeah,
you know? Exactly. So your agent is motivated to help you write if that is the thing you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And if you really are just, like, if you're in the position where you haven't sold anything and you just don't want to try anymore, that's...
Or if you've sold stuff, but you're not under contract.
Yeah, you've been... It's like, it's all done, and you're just sort of like... Your agent is waiting for your next project, and you're just sort of like...
I don't want to make them wait.
I don't want to do this.
The thing I don't think you should do is... I mean, personally, I don't think that you should... I have heard of situations where clients sort of preemptively fire someone because they think that the agent is mad at them for not giving them a book faster.
Oh, yeah.
Which is... I guarantee you never a thing that any agent has ever thought.
Honestly, they are probably just not emailing you because the people who have given them books are like,
or not
more
even
pressing.
Or like, okay, if they're not emailing you and you haven't sent them a book, like, okay, that's one thing. If they have emailed you and you don't have a book and you want to like avoid the conversation of do you want to have a book again, that's not a good reason to fire someone.
No.
Like wanting to avoid that conversation is not a good reason to fire someone because like what happens when you fire them because you don't have a book for them and you know you feel bad or whatever, and then you find someone else down the road, and, like, eventually you're running into the same problems. Like,
And I will say, nearly all agencies that have been around for more than, like, 5 years will have a whole host of backlist clients who haven't sold a book in 5 years, 10 years. And we're perfectly happy to keep them on the books.
Because it doesn't cost us anything.
It doesn't cost us anything. We're willing to sit around and wait and see if they... have any new books that maybe they will. Maybe they'll have some grand idea and really want to write it.
Yeah.
And then we're like, great, happy to work on this. We'll sell this for you.
Like, I was thinking about this the other day in the context of this book that my boss and I were talking about because apparently he was, like, very surprised that I had actually read this book. It's a book called Lives of the Monster Dogs.
Okay.
It came out in, like, 2004, I want to say. It was a book about this race of, like, dogs with hands that like arrived in like turn of the century New York and sort of took over society but then sort of started succumbing to their animal instincts. It was so good. Oh my god. And the author has like never written another book. And like I guarantee you that if that woman ever like emailed her agent like out of the blue 12 years later and was like, hey, I've written another book, that agent would be like, yes, please, because it was a huge bestseller. It was like, it did really well.
Yeah. And for another example, there's Franny Billingsley who took 10 years to write her book Chime, which then was a National Book Award finalist.
Yeah.
Like, it's, we're happy to keep you on the list and keep in touch and just say, okay, well, down the line, if you decide you want to write something, I still love your work and I'd love to represent it.
Yeah.
And if down the line you do write another book and you decide you don't want to work with this agent anymore,
that's
an entirely
different thing.
That's
a question for future
you. Yes.
Like, don't make decisions for future you until you get there.
No, future you has information you, present you doesn't have.
Does not have. So... I guess my our big advice is just, like, hang in there.
Yeah.
Hang in there. And,
I would say to your agent, like, look, I'm just not feeling it right now. I don't have any books I want to work on. There's nothing that's, there aren't any stories in my head. Just so your agent knows where you're at.
Yeah.
But I don't think you need to make any declarations to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't flounce before the flouncing needs to happen.
Yeah.
Just, you know.
And they should understand. It's, I mean, I wouldn't, like, keep then emailing them weekly because they're like...
Still don't want to write.
Yep. Great.
Still not writing. I don't need to know that.
No. It's like, just come back to me if you do. And this is why our agency contract is open-ended.
Yeah. I also started reading The Artist's Way recently, the Julia Cameron book. It's supposed to be about, like, you know, creative recovery. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't gotten through it yet, but I haven't finished it. But it's really interesting, and I think that a lot of people have found it very useful. So it might be something to check out. I don't know. Well, I think that's our only question. So,
man, guys,
yeah, it's summer slowdown, man.
It's true.
Yeah.
Well, I have found this summer that things don't really slow down. It just takes longer for everything to happen.
Mm-hmm.
People still want to do stuff and buy books, but they have to, you know, run it past.
Everyone's in the Hamptons.
Yes.
I'm not in the Hamptons.
No. You were in Tennessee, though.
But I was still checking my email every day.
Yes, but, like, you're also on vacation. You're not going to drop your vacation so that you can read this manuscript someone wants to acquire.
Yeah. So what have you been reading?
I just finished Wolf Hall.
Oh, so good.
Which,
so good.
It was great. I didn't realize how much strongly it was affecting me until I heard someone refer to Thomas Cromwell as, like, a villain in a story. I was like, how dare you?
How very dare you, sir? I will fight you. Pistols at dawn, bitch.
I was like, oh, hey, okay. we were, like, talking about The Tudors, the TV show, and she was like, I don't know if I could just read a book where Thomas Cromwell is the hero because he's such an asshole. And I was like, no.
You are incorrect.
So, yeah. But I also had the whole thing where I really enjoyed how she used third person as first person.
Yes.
I think that that book would have been terrible in first person.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I don't want to actually be in his head. I just want to, like, I did like that because we saw it through his lens.
And you get the sense of being in his head would be insufferable. Because in the first person, Thomas Cromwell would be the fucking worst.
Yes.
You know? He'd be, like, that guy who's, like, really super good at everything.
Yeah.
But, like,
and constantly calculating.
But, like, by having it be, like, a narrow third person,
mm.
you could see him and you could see him be calculating, but you could also see everything around him.
Yes.
And you could also see how everyone around him was sort of, like, reacting to him.
Yeah.
Rather than just sort of his subjective.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good.
The one problem with it is sometimes she just says he, meaning Cromwell, but most of the conversations in this book include more than one man.
So... more than one man named Thomas.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Cromwell and Cranmer and fucking everybody.
More.
Oh, my God. But it means that often she's saying he, and I don't know if she means he Thomas, he Cromwell, or he the person who was just speaking.
So, not to brag on my family or anything, but my mom runs a theater company in Houston, and they got the rights to do Wolf Hall nice. And Bring Out the Bodies. And my mom was talking about how difficult it was to cast, because she's like, you know, normally in a situation like this where there's, like, a cast of thousands, I would just double up the roles, but if everyone's fucking named Thomas, I can't do that, because everyone's gonna get really confused.
You need all the people.
Yeah, basically.
I am, and now that I finished that, I am reading The Queen of Atolia.
Ah, yes.
Which everyone...
have I read that one? Is that the new one?
That's the second one.
Oh, right. I have read that. I have read that. It's good.
Everyone has been telling me, like, this is where it gets really good, because I read The Thief and I was like, I understand why everyone likes this, but it does my biggest narrative pet peeve. And I saw it happening. And I was like,
you always do that, though.
It drives me crazy.
That's not... your problem isn't that you're too picky. Your problem is you're trying to outsmart the book.
Well,
you're trying to get ahead of the book. And sometimes you just need to let the book happen.
I wasn't trying. It was right there on the page.
Not for everybody, though. And I think that, you know, you just need to turn that part of your brain off.
I mean, well, okay. Comparing this...
this is like the fourth book where you're like, I've seen the twist coming.
Well, I didn't see it in The Raven Boys. And it was there on the page, and it still completely blew me away. But this one, but you know what the fact is? The difference is whether the characters are missing information, and that's revealed in the twist, or if the narrator is lying, is withholding information, and that's revealed in the twist. And that's what The Thief is. If the narrator, the first person narrator whose head you're in, is not telling you something, so there's a dramatic reveal at the end, then I get mad.
Bridget, like, you can't see it, but she's, like, pointing. She's, like, super angry right now.
It drives me crazy.
She's so mad.
You don't get to lie to yourself so that the reader is surprised. It makes me really mad.
She's, like, really red in the face. She's, like, really angry about it. I'm just going to take some of your wine just because you're so upset.
No.
Damn it.
You don't get to do that. So, like, I am okay with characters who are lying to other people, and I'm okay with characters who don't know things, and that's revealed in the twist. And often I miss that. Like, I miss that in The Raven Boys. I miss that in The Demon's Lexicon. He, you know, and Codename Verity, I sort of was like, I don't think she's telling the truth, but I didn't really know what was in there. And all of those books I absolutely love. Like, I think they're wonderful, and I think the twist ending works brilliantly in all of them. It's when the first person narrator is like, aren't I sneaky, guys? I hid this from you, that I get really mad. So that's what happens in The Thief. So I have told many people about this, and they're like, oh, you need to read The Queen of Atolia. So finally I got it from the library. And so far I like it a lot. It's very smart, and it's engaging, and it's got cool stuff going on, and I'm not quite, it's in third person, so I'm not quite so mad when surprise things happen. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. What are you reading, Jen?
Well, I read a ton on vacation, which I'm actually going to do a blog post about because it was like 9 books, including finishing The Night Circus, which I had never finished, but I really loved.
Had you started it before?
I had started it as part of the sort of like long distance book club that I was doing with my cousin, but something happened and I just never finished it. And so I finally finished it like while I was on vacation. I was like, oh my God, that's so good.
I haven't read that one yet.
It's really good. I was very surprised. Also, like, I thought that it did some very interesting things. It was just fun. It was just like a fun read.
That's good.
What else did I read on vacation that was interesting? Just lots of cool stuff. Currently, I have started 3 books. I'm about 200 pages into a nonfiction book called The Rape of Europa, which is about, which is about, like, Nazi art theft. Like, the sort of program of Nazi confiscation of art.
Interesting.
It's fascinating and horrifying. Yeah. Because I had, I got this book at the Neue Gallery. It was, like, a National Book Critics Circle Award winner, like, a while ago. And I got it because there was this movie, I think it's called The Woman in Gold, with Ryan Gosling and Helen Mirren, where Helen Mirren plays a woman who, her family was, you know, persecuted by the Nazis, and the Nazis confiscated this portrait of her aunt, and it's Klimt's Woman in Gold. It's the woman with, like, the Edwardian hairdo and, like, the gold dress, sort of, like, color-blocked.
Mm-hmm.
They stole that, basically. And then it had been hanging in a museum in Germany, like, since World War II. And so she hired this, like, young lawyer to sort of be like, this painting's mine. It was my family's.
I think I heard about this.
Yeah. The movie, I don't think, came out very wide here. I think it was in the UK, mostly. But she won. And then when she won, she, like, immediately sold the painting for, like, an ass load of money, which is, I'm like, good for you, bitch. Yeah. Like, good job. But so this book is basically about because Hitler was an artist, and he had very strong ideas about, like, what art meant and what was art and what wasn't. And so it started out talking about sort of, like, degenerate art, which is basically, like, modern art, like Picasso and Braque and Kandinsky and stuff like that. But then it sort of goes into how, like, ideology, like, fell by the wayside when greed got involved, because, like, there were all these Nazis who were, like, dealing extensively on the black market and, like, you know, stealing collections from Jewish families that they'd, like, deported to concentration camps and then, like, selling them for, like, millions of dollars. And I mean, it's really horrifying. Like the whole thing, like, you know, you think that you're talking about, like, art, which is, like, this sort of frivolous subject, and you're like, oh, my God.
No.
Oh, my God, everything is the worst.
God.
And then and then there are all these wonderful scenes where they, you know, my joke to my sister was, like, you know, the sort of French stereotype of, like, bureaucracy and red tape must have been invented, like, around this time period, because the officials at, like, the Louvre in, like, occupied, you know, Vichy France, like, were doing everything in their power to, like, keep art from leaving the country.
Yeah.
So they would, like, invent these, like, hugely complicated, you know, reasons that, like, this painting couldn't go to another country. And then you have these, like, beautiful touching moments. Like, I just got to the part where, you know, obviously Germany invades Soviet Russia, and the author's like, I don't know why anyone was surprised that this happened, because it was pretty clear. But it was, you know, the curators at the Hermitage Museum, like, packing everything up into cases and, like, putting them on trains and crying as they leave, you know, St. Petersburg. You're just like, oh, my God. Or Leningrad. But so I'm reading that. I started reading.
That's, you know, honestly, one of the things that makes me really sad when I watch movies is when, like, ancient buildings are destroyed.
Oh, my God.
As an archaeologist, I'm just like, no.
Yeah. Never Google the destruction of the library at Louvain, like, or the bombing of Dresden. Yeah. Just don't. God.
And like, the whole thing with ISIS.
Oh my God, don't talk about it.
I can't.
Although a lot of that city was fine.
Yes.
It was not great, but it was mostly fine.
Yeah.
And then there was that Ethiopian guy who like saved
all
those.
Oh my God, librarian!
Yeah.
Like, yes! Oh my God! Oh my God! It's like one of my favorites.
Give me the fantasy novel about that guy. So I'm reading that, which is, it's like really slow reading because I had to sort of like stop and cry for a little bit. And then I'm reading Ken Liu's book.
The Grace of Kings.
Yes.
Yes, I got it.
The Grace of Kings. I'll be interested to hear what you think of it. I'm only 50 pages in, so I feel like it's a long ass book. So I feel like it's just sort of gathering steam at this point.
Yeah.
I really love the world, so that's cool.
I haven't read it yet. I saw him read at KGB last fall, maybe. He's a very good reader. He puts a lot of emphasis into it and a lot of animation into when he's reading his own work, which is admirable, and definitely a skill that writers should cultivate. And he also seems, he's a lawyer. So,
really?
Yeah.
I don't think I knew that. That's adorable.
I think he's a tax lawyer. So like it's a whole book about taxes, basically. And it draws very much on his own personal knowledge from his career, which I found really interesting.
I have not gotten to the taxes part, but
we'll see. I think he's a tax lawyer.
If not, it's a cool story, and we're just going to keep telling it.
Yeah. I'm interested to read it. I just haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah. Well, I'm like 50 pages into that one. I mean, my reading is sort of determined on like how heavy my bag is going to be that day.
Yes.
So I get more reading on, like, denser books done on days when I'm not, like, going to the gym or going to work because I have less to carry. So my other book that's sort of, like, the midpoint between the two is A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara.
Isn't that one, like, also 800 pages?
The paperback version is not. Oh, I mean, okay. It is, but it's, like, 900 paperback pages as opposed to, like, hardcover. It's, like, it weighs noticeably less.
Yes.
So far, I like it.
Okay.
I like it, the question mark. I have not gotten far enough into it.
Yeah.
All the reviews I've read are like, shit gets harrowing, and I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can deal with that. So we'll see how I feel about it. But it's beautifully written, like it's very evocative, so we'll see.
I don't know if I'm quite up for a 900 page harrowing book. I don't know.
See, I like dark shit, so
it's true.
You know, it's probably gonna be like my thing.
Yes.
But I guess that is it for now. Next time we will talk about something, I don't know, and we will also record the Ariar episode of the Crows Against Saga.
We're gonna have to look that up.
Shipping and Handling Book Club.
It's the Alien B of
oh my God, Ariar. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening and tuning in.
Yes.
I know you're all on summer vacation, but if you have any questions or comments or concerns or suggestions or anything, you can send them to us via email at shippingandhandlingpodcast@gmail.com or via Twitter at shipandhandling or on Twitter where you can ask or Tumblr where you can ask anonymously, shippingandhandlingpodcast. .tumblr.com. And please, if you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We're also on Stitcher. Please let us know if that is working for you, because we are definitely publishing to that platform, but we want to make sure that everyone is
can get it.
Yes. Everyone can get it.
I tested it, but I want to make, I'm not like listening to it habitually.
I sometimes like road test the podcast, like if I'm at the gym and I like need something to listen to for the last like 15 minutes or whatever, I'm just like, let's see how it sounds out in the wild.
Oh, doing things.
And it sounds great.
I do usually listen to it on the subway, which honestly actually means I often can't get my phone up high enough. Like the volume doesn't go high enough that I can really hear
you need
us.
More powerful headphones, my friend.
That may be it.
I have some Bluetooth over-the-ear ones. It's amazing.
I don't bring my giant over-the-ear ones, which are studio headphones, which I love, but they are enormous.
I ordered these for like $20 on Amazon. They're like not fancy.
Mine were
like
$70.
The little logo on the side says wireless headphones. You're like, well, yes, they are, because
yes,
there's no wire.
Tell.
I can tell. Well, on that note, thank you again so much for listening, and bye.